Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with new findings on a well-known fact. The fact that COVID-19 disproportionately impacts people and communities of color and people with lower incomes. The new findings, research published in the journal Social Science and Medicine, which finds that when white Americans learn of those disparities, they become less empathetic, feel less fear about the virus, and are less likely to support safety measures. So what to do with that? We immediately wanted to ask two people that we have talked to the most about racial disparities in COVID and healthcare over these last couple of years. They join us now. Dr. Joseph Betancourt is the Senior Vice President for Equity and Community Health at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's actually joining us from Detroit right now, where he's at a meeting. And Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's Board of Directors. Dr. Betancourt, welcome back.
Thank you. Really appreciate you having me today, and great to be here with my friend, Michael Curry.
Great to have you, and Michael, the friend, welcome back to you, too.
Glad to be here.
I think many of us consider you friends, Michael. It's great to have both of you. I think I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it first anyway. Michael, do these findings surprise you?
No, they don't surprise me. I mean, one, we think about what the report is telling us, and it's telling us that if you are not closer to the disease, if you've not experienced it, if you've not seen it in your community in the same way that others have, then you may think that it doesn't touch you. And I think part of what the work that Dr. Betancourt's been doing for years and many others in this space is to make everyone realize that this is a disease that is impacting all people. All people across the globe. And unfortunately, it impacts those who are poor, those who are essential workers, those who have historically dealt with inequities and systemic racism, and therefore carry higher burdens of disease. This is a disease that impacts everybody. This has implications around HIV, AIDS, and other diseases, poverty, and violence, where people think it's another person's problem and not theirs, but it is all of our problem.
Dr. Betancourt, let me just let you pick it up there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I'm disappointed, of course, as we always are, but not surprised. I think that this adds to a broad literature that demonstrates that when, individuals who are deemed, less worthy, inferior, and of course this breaks down by race and class, people care less. It's the othering. It's this base human instinct that we see where people get blamed, and it breaks, again, along race and class lines. Races and classism play a major role here. You know, I think it's important to put this study in context. This study did happen in September 2020, early on, perhaps before, everybody did feel the burden in a more general way, although we were out of our first surge. And it's also, I found interesting that the study surveyed those individuals with incomes between $40,000 and $50,000, which it may tell us in a more particular way which demographics perhaps might kind of fall in line with these thoughts. And I think the politicization as well of the pandemic, and as Michael mentioned, this idea that it was happening to a particular demographic, but due to these social determinants, due to issues related to structural racism, that made others feel, well, it's happening to those people over there. And as a result, my freedoms are more important than it shouldn't be impacted by these issues because it's not happening to me or to us.
So there's a lot to unpack there. And I do want to acknowledge that there is research that shows that when you consider somebody another, it will reduce your empathy for that other person. So there are two or three things I want to try to understand. The first is pulling out things you both said. To what extent does this research suggest to us that when I can see that it's happening to someone else, I'm just less afraid of it, versus when I can see that it's happening to someone else, I am less compassionate about and less willing to take care of them, and that might be compounded by racism? Can both be at play, and can they be at play separately, or are they sort of completely interlinked, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think they can both be at play. One of the things that really caught me about the report, and I think Dr. Betancourt touched on this a little, which is we talk about the academic or the academic achievement of the population, but even their racial bias, how racist they are, how much bias are they sort of living within in their lives. And the more conscious they are of history and culture, then the less they tend to be biased. Or let me change that. The study says the less they tend to carry these notion that it's about someone else and it's not their problem, and the more empathetic they are. The report talks quite a bit about empathy. So the reality is, I think part of this goes back to this whole thing that all of us have been really trying to beat the drum on. We need to raise the consciousness of Americans around systemic racism, institutional racism, around how bias has played out in the history of this country that disadvantages certain communities, in this, and particularly BIPOC communities. And then once they get that understanding, they approach everything differently. They approach public health differently. They have a different interest in supporting their fellow citizens who just happen to live in a different zip code or be of a different race. And we have not done that really hard work of level setting ourselves as a nation on this country's history and the inequities that exist in society. So I think that that work is really critical.
So in listening to Michael Curry there, Dr. Betancourt, I am thinking about our early conversations with you during the pandemic as you were bringing data forward about these disparities. And the report does underscore that when people are more aware of the systemic history of racism in the country, they're able to take this information in a different way. You know, and over these last couple of years, COVID has sort of said the quiet parts out loud or laid bare what we knew was true but not paying attention to from a public health and race and poverty perspective. What do we do now to educate people better, like Michael's saying, keep those quiet parts out loud and start to take steps?
I think we need to communicate in basic ways to people, obviously, bring empathy, bring understanding, and bring history to bear. You know, I think we, as best we can, need to depoliticize these issues in a time that's highly political. And certainly, this varies by place, by state, by geography, you know, very significantly. And I think we are fortunate in our state and in our city that, you know, we mobilized a lot of efforts. I think we have a lot to be proud of. I think we did bring a diverse set of stakeholders to this. But ultimately, we lead with the evidence. We give people a chance to see, you know, what this looks like. And we talk about, you know, why certain neighborhoods are disadvantaged. And we really push back on this notion that, you know, communities of color were impacted because of some genetic susceptibility. And instead really talk about the points that Michael made, the social determinants, multi-generational housing, essential workers, individuals who are more likely to use public transportation, all issues that really, really drove the first wave on top of, you know, issues around disparities that did make people more vulnerable to doing poorly with COVID because of higher burdens of diabetes or heart disease, which, you know, it's a vicious cycle. It takes us back to social determinants, issues of race and classes and racism. So, but, you know, these are things that can be complicated, and it's our responsibility to communicate them in clear, you know, basic ways for people to understand them and to really rally behind them.
And Michael, let's touch on the double-edged sword of that. When producer Walter Wuthman and I were first talking about this report, one of the things we thought was, okay, but if we talk more about it, are we leading more? You know, the report says these findings suggest that publicizing racial health disparities has the potential to create a vicious cycle wherein raising awareness reduces support for the very policies that could protect public health and reduce disparities. What do we do with that double-edged sword?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's an option, right? I'm going to use from all my friends out there who love hip hop, there's a line that's really popular now, shine a light on them. And the reality is we're shining a light on disparities for a reason. The shining a light on them, as Dr. Betancourt knows, early in this pandemic in 2020, if we hadn't shined a light on all the disparities, both the infection, hospitalization, and death rates, then we wouldn't have deployed the resources in the way we did here and across the country. If we didn't shine a light on them, then we couldn't have had the interventions in place, the mitigation strategies that we put in place to save lives and protect lives. So there is a reason why we shine a light on it and why we publicize it and why people write articles about it. But we have to do two things. One, we have to do that, but we also have to educate the broader public that this is about disease. This is about a pandemic. And quite frankly, white Americans bore a burden from this disease as well here and across the globe. We got to tell those stories too. And we got to lift up those stories as well. Because if you know, I always say about diabetes, diabetes may have impacted my communities I grew up in a disproportionate way, but I can connect with a white family of any background because they've had diabetes in their home as well. because they've had cancer in their home as well, prostate, breast cancer. We have to connect across those lines, as well as tell the story about how certain communities are bearing the burden in a greater way.
And Joseph Betancourt, where here in Greater Boston are you seeing that being done well in our last minute or so?
Yeah, you know, we have, fortunately, in the Greater Boston area, the ability to bring people together. And I think we talked about this, you know, during the last time we connected, this idea of we are a community that does communicate, that does bring key stakeholders together. And I think we've, you know, compared to other places, tried to do a better job around that. And I think there has been a good deal of empathy when we think about some of the hotspots. And as Michael said, what we've been able to mobilize in the hotspots. And so, you know, in some other places where there's a highly politicized kind of perspective, you know, these issues become a lot more challenging because that othering is very, very potent. Here, I think we need to continue to push the collective action to caring for each other. And that's what this is really all about. But always, centering caring for those who are most vulnerable, no matter who they are or where they're from.
All right. That is Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who is the Senior Vice President for Equity and Community Health at Mass General Hospital. Dr. Betancourt, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, appreciate you as well. Thanks.
Thank you. And safe travels to Dr. Betancourt.
Staffers in the Massachusetts State Senate want to unionize. They informed Senate President Karen Spilka late last week. They are asking for better pay and benefits, protection from abuse in the workplace, and a clearer way to redress complaints. They have enough signatures, but it's unclear whether legally they can unionize. Massachusetts law currently recognizes the right to collective bargaining by state employees, but doesn't recognize employees of the legislative branch. Here with us now, one staffer helping to organize the union, Shelley McNeil, who is the chief of staff for Senator Michael Moore, a Democrat from Worcester. Shelley, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So let me just start with, how long have you been a Senate staffer, and what do you do in your work?
Sure. So I started in the building in 1994. I was with a state representative at the time, so I spent several years working in the House of Representatives. And then when she ran for Senate, I followed her to the Senate. We started in the Senate in 1999, and I stayed there for a while. I left for a couple years, had my third child, and came back in 2005, and I've been there since.
So almost 30 years. Yep. Why unionize now?
I think now is just, there have been so many changes over the last 5 to 10 years. I think now was just the right time. There was enough momentum for it. I think staff have really come together. The pandemic brought a lot of things to light, that things became a little bit more glaring during the pandemic in terms of the things we need to be able to do our jobs,
like,
and
what?
The struggles we had. Computers, for one thing. We didn't have, you know, work computers to bring home with us. We left on a Friday, and that was it. We didn't go back to the building. So, I personally had to buy my own computer for at home. I didn't have one at the time that supported the Senate's software. So I had to purchase my own equipment. We had to use our own cell phones.
Now, there was this $500 stipend.
Yeah. I mean, that didn't cover my technology needs, but it was appreciated. I can assure you, many of us did appreciate that. But, you know, it didn't cover all the costs.
And what do you think being unionized will allow you to do that you can't do now?
Well, I think it gives us a seat at the table. It gives us a voice in the workplace. It ensures that when we see an issue, that it will be recognized and can be discussed. And we don't have those assurances right now.
So the sort of the ability to organize into a union is an interesting piece of this. So you informed the state Senate President Karen Spilka of your intentions last week, announced sort of formally to the public yesterday. Spilka's office sent us a statement that had been a public statement. It says, quote, "As a lifelong advocate of workers' rights and a champion of organized labor, I have worked very hard with my colleagues to make the Senate a fairer and more equitable workplace. I am aware that a union's effort to organize Senate staff is underway, and I have asked Senate counsel to carefully review." Now, as I understand it, there are some who believe that even though the law doesn't grant explicitly the right of legislative staffers to organize, that State Senate President Spilka could choose to acknowledge the union.
Correct.
Or it would be necessary for legislators to pass a bill, allowing it. Where do things stand right now?
We're unsure. We have not heard directly from the Senate president as of yet in terms of her. She has not responded to the letter that we dropped off directly to us. She did give a statement to the press, which was somewhat supportive, and she has been a very strong supporter of the labor movement in the past. So I think it really is just going to depend on her, Senate counsel, what they determine the need be and whether they decide to support us or not.
And what are you hearing in the rumblings?
I think that there's general support. I mean, obviously, that we've had almost 10 senators come out in support of the union effort on Twitter. They've made statements in support. We've had some great support from other groups. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley just offered her support. Different labor leaders have offered their support. So I think there is a strong sentiment that, a union is a good thing for Senate staffers and for the Commonwealth. So I think it's just a matter of figuring out what the best way forward is.
So let's push on this a little bit. Sure. Were you to be successful, we would be only the second state in the U.S. to do this. Oregon did it last year. Other states, some have even gone in the opposite direction. The governor in Wisconsin limits state worker unions in part because of the cost to taxpayers.
Right.
What about the concerns about the affordability of the demands that Senate staffers are making and the fact that this is actually, if you look across 50 states, a very unusual move?
It is unusual. I mean, clearly, when you're the second group trying to do this. But I think there's cost benefits, too. When you look at our pay structure, there isn't any real clear sort of process right now. It used to be that senators were given a pot of money. They could divide it up. If you wanted to pay one staffer a lot of money and another staffer not so much, and they were willing to accept that, that's what you got. I think what having a standard across the board brings us is consistency and
So you were not a fan of that sort of largesse approach?
Well, it has its benefits if you're,
the one who gets more.
gaining from it. But for the people who aren't, and it is exclusionary. So if you can't afford to, work in those conditions, you can't work there. It's difficult for people. Like, think about people from Central Mass and Western Mass and the amount it costs to travel into Boston to do the work in the State House. That's a huge difference than the people who are just living in Boston who might be able to jump on the T or walk to work.
And do you know the average salary of a Senate staffer?
I don't know the actual average salary, but, it really depends on the position.
So I understand that the starting salary is around $45,000.
It's around $45,000, yeah.
All right, so earlier today, we spoke with one of your colleagues, a fellow organizer on this, Evan Barry.
Mm-hmm.
Evan is a communications director for Senator Becca Rausch. Here's Evan.
Of course, as staff, we're organizing here because of our workplace conditions, but let's zoom out. Brain drain is in this building, hurts our democracy, it hurts our communities, and it's plain and simple. The diversity of our Commonwealth should be represented in our legislative staff. And honestly, if people of color and people from different socioeconomic backgrounds can't afford to stay in this work, it has huge repercussions on our laws and, by extension, our communities.
Can you give us an example of what Evan's talking about?
Like a personal example? I mean, when you have younger staffer coming in, and they're starting off and they don't get health insurance for 60 days. There were staffers who started during the pandemic who didn't know that they weren't going to have health insurance when they accepted the job. So finding that out during a pandemic, that's difficult. And when we know the pandemic affected communities of color at greater proportion, if you're a staffer, those things have ramifications.
And are you seeing, my understanding is that there was quite a bit of resignation after the Equal Pay Act that was passed in 2016 was implemented in 2018.
Yep.
What about that institutional knowledge of how the work gets done in the State House? Do we keep that year to year, or are you seeing the more seasoned staffers leaving? How do we think about that?
I think it's been a mix. I think that newer people have come in and then they've left very quickly. And we've had seasoned staff. Our office alone lost almost 30 years of experience out the door within the last 3 to 5 years. And it was mostly a result of pay. And that's problematic. Those positions have built relationships. They've built credibility within the building. People trust their voices because they've built those relationships over time.
And Shelley, what about people who would push back and say there are so many other great benefits that you get if you're a state worker, you should be willing to earn a little bit less?
Like?
What's your response? Like state pension. So that's your answer is like.
Oh, would you like to talk about my pension? I'd love to talk about that. Take a look at the Group 1 pension chart. It's nothing glamorous. You know, there are different groups. We are not, I would have to work quite a long time to hit my 80%. And quite frankly, when you work for a legislator who gets reelected every 2 years, that's very difficult to do. I'm not the norm to have been there for as long as I've been and to have only worked for 2 legislators. I happen to work for legislators who have done well in their district and stayed a long time or not left for other higher office or other, you know, private sector jobs. But I think with that, we're also not asking to be staffers for life in this movement.
Yeah.
Because I think there is a misconception about, you know, people unionizing and then just wanting to stay. We understand that legislators get elected every 2 years and
There go your fortunes
and,
accordingly.
Yep.
All right. That is Shelley McNeil. She is the chief of staff for State Senator Mike Moore and among the Senate staffers pushing to unionize. Shelley, good of you to come in and talk with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We finish today with celebration and healing. That is the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra rehearsing the opening of Mahler's Third Symphony. They'll be closing their season with a performance of this epic, record-breaking work this Friday night at Symphony Hall. We caught up with the orchestra's founder and conductor, Benjamin Zander, this week to talk about the piece and to reflect on the close of their first season back to live in-person performances since the pandemic began. I started by asking Ben how he was feeling about the orchestra's final performance of the season.
Very excited. Last time I did it was 20 years ago, so people should take note. If I do it every 20 years, I'll be 103 when we do it the next time. In the Guinness Book of World Records, it's listed as the longest symphony ever written. But it's not only the length, it's also the size of the conception, the sheer number of players, 107 musicians on stage, some musicians off stage, 2 choirs. I mean, it's just an unbelievable undertaking, and it happens very rarely. Because it's so big and so complicated and so expensive, frankly.
So let's talk about that. And it feels to some extent like picking a song this momentous is symbolic for the end of this season, because this is your first season back after sort of the world as we knew it ended in February 2020. How has it been to be back this year and have audiences flocked back to you?
Right. We will have given 7 concerts in Symphony Hall, all of them very well attended and wildly reacted to, just an amazingly beautiful reaction of the audience. The excitement in the hall, you know, you have to have a terrible experience in order to appreciate what you had before. And we're all experiencing that now. The miracle of listening after the pandemic is that nobody coughs in the concerts. You don't hear a single cough because everybody's masked and they're so conscious of coughing. That means we're listening to music in silence for the first time in our lifetime.
Do you notice that from the stage?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the first concert, I noticed the most striking thing was nobody even talked in the in intervals between the movements. It was complete silence. And that is a magical thing. If you get 1,500 or 2,000 people in a hall, all of them completely silent and listening with absolute attention. Of course, the acoustics in that hall, people don't realize the acoustics of Symphony Hall are the most perfect acoustics of any hall in the world. And so you can hear the softest sounds, I mean, the most preciously soft sound, and also the grandest, biggest sounds that you've ever heard in your life. So it's completely thrilling. And the players are electrified by this experience. They love this music with a passion, every one of them.
Is there anything that you would keep or want to keep from the adaptations made during the pandemic? I hear the joy of being back.
Right.
And even the post-pandemic difference that you're welcoming. Yeah. But is there anything from those 2 years
actually,
you would
there
keep?
Actually, there are several things. One thing that I did with my youth orchestra, because the Boston Philharmonic, we closed down. We couldn't give concerts. But with the youth orchestra, something very wonderful happened, which is we couldn't play, but I turned them all into conductors. So we taught them each week at the same time as the usual rehearsal, taught them all the elements of conducting, of leadership, of score reading, of being aware of other instruments. And when we came back to play in person, there was a new level of awareness, which I had never experienced before, because usually players in an orchestra will think about their own part, their own connection with their section. But now they're listening to the whole, listening to the flute, listening to the trombone, listening to all the other instruments. And there's a new awareness, a new sense of responsibility for the whole, which is very exciting.
So I am excited to get into the performance of Mahler and talk about those musical clips. You mentioned the youth orchestra, so I do want to take a moment there. And I want to talk to you about some challenges there over the last few years around David St. George, a former advisor for the Boston Philharmonic Youth Orchestra, who pleaded guilty possession of child pornography last week. So this is a legacy from 2018. He left then. Benjamin Vickers resigned from the organization at that time, too, after some concerns over inappropriate emails. We are 4 years on now. You're talking about that youth symphony and how you guided them through the pandemic and kept them connected with the music.
Right.
How did you rebuild trust with parents over that time? And with the St. George plea last week, are you in a moment where you're closing a book? And how are you closing that book to ensure the health of that program and the kids going forward?
The book was closed 3.5 years ago. I mean, he was very involved. He was a wonderful supporter and a tremendous colleague. But since he was arrested 3.5 years ago, I haven't had any contact with him. We haven't seen him. His name is never mentioned. So it literally disappeared. And I don't think anybody noticed the most recent thing. So it's in the past, the whole thing. And what I focus on in every rehearsal, at every moment of every rehearsal, is not only the music, but on building leaders, on focusing on always finding a possibility path for them through the assignments I give them each week, through the interchange about music, through the white sheets which I put on the stand. So we're in a tremendous growth period with all these young people, and we're going on tour to Greece. We were going to go to Russia. That would have been a very different experience, but that was cancelled. Now we're focused totally on giving our final concert, which is on May 6th, which is a beautiful thing. It's linked to the original idea of going to Russia, since the music is Russian, but it's all the money from the tickets is going directly to help children in Ukraine.
And this is the Youth Orchestra's May 6th concert.
Right, May 6th in Symphony Hall.
And what pieces will
you
be playing there?
And we're playing the Shostakovich Festive Overture, which he wrote immediately after Stalin's death, so we know that he was celebrating that. And then
it's kind of an interesting irony there, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And then Prokofiev's third piano concerto with Alexander Kosanchu, who's from Georgia and passionately against Putin. I mean, he gave a very beautiful speech to the youth orchestra. I mean, people were just riveted by him. And he's playing the third piano concerto of Prokofiev, who incidentally was born in Ukraine.
Okay. Long, involved, complex piece. You've got a conductor's book in front of me, and the pages are incredible. I mean, original print of all the different musical voices and then your notes. It's a complex piece. The sixth movement is also a meditation on love. Can you talk a little more about that?
This is the very first rehearsal on this movement, and I could feel a sense of peace, of calm, of resolution in the players as they played it for the first time. All their anxiety and tension and fear, all of them masked, all of them still living under the cloud, but playing this heavenly music. and being taken to a place that actually we can't reach any other way than through great music. And it was I got a letter at the end of this rehearsal. It was a very short note, you know, because I put out a white sheet on the stand of every musician at every rehearsal, so they can write about anything, they can comment about something in the music or something. And she wrote, at the end of this very rehearsal, she says, 5 years ago today, I was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer at age 37. Mm. Thank you for this incredible opportunity to celebrate life, health, and love. What Mahler does is he starts with the description of the earth. The first movement, which lasts 35 minutes, is a huge battle for life against the forces of inertia and death. And these two forces meet together in a tremendous battle. And then there's a triumphant march where summer, because it's a battle between winter and summer, where summer is triumphant. And then it goes from there up the chain of being. Second movement is about what the plants and flowers say. Then the next movement is what animals, playful, rambunctious animals, and then man himself in a beautiful alto solo with a soloist woman, and then what the angels say, and that's when we bring in the boys and the women.
The choirs.
The choir, the two choirs.
And you will have two live choirs at that performance.
Two live choirs, and then finally in the sixth movement, love itself, which is this awe-inspiring, just deep expression of joy, but also of the struggle and suffering.
So we're playing a little bit more here because you flagged this part of
yes.
it as being really emotional.
This is where
where
the flute and the oboe and the clarinet are playing together like one new instrument. Listen to that sound of those three instruments playing. And it builds and builds up to a great climax of warm intensity.
There's this last bit of music that you brought in with you today that you really wanted us
yes.
to play as we were closing. Right. So I'm going to play a little bit of that now.
It's just before the end, and it builds to an unimaginable pitch of exalted affirmation that is irresistible. It's as if Mahler's looking out over all of creation, an anthem for the world. Imagine if this could be heard by everybody in the world, a healing place.
That was Boston Philharmonic Orchestra founder and conductor Benjamin Zander. The orchestra will close out its season with a performance of Mahler's Third Symphony Friday at Symphony Hall. You can find more information and a link to a lecture about the composition from Zander at our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Walter Wolfman, Francisca Monahan, and Sarah Leeson. We had help today from Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.